From CAFE, this is United Security. I'm Ken Weinstein. So today we're continuing our series of interviews that we've been doing over the last month or so. As you recall, we have had interviews with several national security officials and experts from the Obama administration. We had Matt Olson and we had John Brennan. And then most recently, we had two episodes with Jim Clapper, all of whom were, you know, in a number of different administrations, but ended up their service or their last service in the Obama administration. I'm delighted to be joined today by Courtney Elwood. Courtney served as the general counsel of the CIA for nearly the entirety of the Trump administration. Courtney has had a varied and successful career in government. She started her career as a clerk for the longtime Supreme Court Chief Justice, William Rehnquist, held a number of positions in the Bush White House, and most recently served as CIA's top lawyer. Courtney Elwood, it's an honor to speak with you. Welcome to the show.
I'm very pleased to be here. This is fun.
It is fun. It's great to have you. So thank you for taking the time. And I know you're probably very actively decompressing right now. And so I'm glad you could fit this into your decompression regime. And so why don't I just take a minute, just for efficiency's sake, just to tick off your resume. And then we're going to go back and I'm going to ask you about sort of each step along the way. So Courtney was born and raised in the Washington, D.C. area, actually raised right near where I was raised, and we went to the same high school. Unfortunately, she came along a good bit after I did. I was in a much earlier class, ergo I'm older, but we both went to a wonderful school right in the Northern Virginia suburbs of Washington, D.C. She then went from high school to Washington and Lee University in Virginia, graduated from there, and went on to get a law degree at a place called Yale Law School. I think I've heard of it, up in New Haven, Connecticut. And then from there, she went on to be a law clerk to two different judges. First, she was with Judge Michael Luttig on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. And then from there, went to the Supreme Court, where she clerked for the Chief Justice, William Rehnquist, heard of him as well. And that was 2 years of clerkship before she then went into private practice at a law firm here in town, D.C., that is, Kellogg, Huber, Hansen, Todd, Evans, and Feigl, very, very strong firm here in town, until 2001, after the inauguration of President George W. Bush, she went into the White House to be an associate counsel to the president. She did that for a while before taking maternity leave and having a child, and then coming back in to be deputy counsel to Vice President Dick Cheney, once again, back in the White House. And from there, she went over to the Justice Department, where she and I had the opportunity to work closely together, where she was counselor and then deputy chief of staff to the attorney general at the time, Alberto Gonzalez. I know you had gotten to know Judge Gonzalez in your time at the White House when he was White House counsel. And then from there, you left government service and went back out to your law firm, Kellogg Huber, until 2017. At the front end of the Trump administration, you came in as the general counsel of the CIA. And remained in that position until 13 days ago. So all those were, you know, incredible credentials, incredible experiences, but probably the most, even though they were neato torpedo, the most important accomplishments of your life are raising two wonderful kids here in Alexandria. And then secondly, can't go through this without mentioning that you were a fabulous co-coach of the Alexandria girls' six-year-old soccer team that totally cleaned up and dominated the league the years that you're a co-coach. I'm trying to remember who you coached with.
Yeah, I think that I had the good judgment to let Mr. Weinstein take the lead on coaching. And I think I brought the snacks. But
that was fun. We were like the Alabama football program of Alexandria soccer. We could probably spend 20 minutes talking about the exploits of our soccer girls, but we'll get back to national security. And then just to round things out, you're married to one John Elwood, who's not a half bad lawyer himself, and a good friend of mine too. He also is a Supreme Court law clerk, held important legal positions in the Justice Department at the Solicitor General's office and the Office of Legal Counsel, and now is heading up an appellate practice at a law firm here in town, Arnold & Porter. So that just gives a sort of an overview of who you are and what you've done. With that in mind, why don't you tell us a little bit about your family background, your parents, what they did, and maybe the impact they had on you and the direction of your career?
Sure. So my parents, Ken, like yours, we're part of the greatest generation. My father was born in 1921 and was coming out of college during World War II and initially joined the Army, but quickly decided that was not for him. And he went into the Marine Corps thereafter and served in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. As he emerged from Vietnam, he had done some writing. He had prepared to be a journalist before going into the Marine Corps, done some writing while in the Marine Corps. But as he was coming out, he realized or recognized that the Marine Corps didn't have a historical program, which is hard to believe because the Marines love their history. So he started the Marine Corps history program, started their museums, and then devoted the next stage of his career, both still in uniform and then as a civilian in the Marine Corps history program. So he gave 50 plus years of his life to the Marine Corps.
General Simmons, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And just on that, so he was World War II, Korea, and Vietnam.
Yes.
And did you mention that he was in the Chosin Reservoir even?
I didn't. You know, he did have, you know, combat in all three wars, but certainly the Korean War was, you know, probably, well, and certainly the most difficult for him. He was both at Incheon and at Chosin. And I'm sure I didn't fully appreciate growing up, you know, quite what that meant. He didn't talk. He didn't dwell upon his experiences in the wars. He wasn't, you know, regaling us with war stories at the dinner table, but I've come to more appreciate it as I've become an adult. And also learned, you know, even, and I can talk about this later, during my time at CIA, I encountered people who my father mentored, who I had no idea, you know, about his relationship with these people. They, you know, figured out who I was and came to me and told me about their own personal experience with him and how he influenced their lives and led them to the CIA in one way or another.
Yeah, and what an incredible service to have been in combat in three different wars. And just, I read not too long ago a long description of the Battle of Chosin Reservoir and just how brutal that was and incredible sacrifice. And in fact, he was still in Vietnam right after you were born, wasn't he?
He actually served two tours. He was one of the first in and one of the last out. So he did a tour in 1965 to 66. And while he was on that tour, my sister was born. He came home. I was born in 1968. And then he returned from 1970 to 72.
So you spent a year or two without your dad?
Sure. Mm-hmm. I don't remember it. But I do know that it was much harder on my mother dealing with all of us.
I imagine. So how about your mom?
So my mom is another sort of great American story. She was the daughter of immigrants. Her mother was born in Italy. Her parents divorced when she was 18 months old, which at the time was sort of unprecedented. And so she was raised by her sort of mother's family who, you know, spoke Italian at home, and all of her, you know, nearly a dozen aunts and uncles who all lived together. In quite poor conditions, but a very full family household. She slept in a bed with four of her aunts and uncles. She was very poor, but, you know, was very loved. But then she was sent off when she was about 11, probably because of the Depression, to live in California with her father, who she was sort of estranged from. She bounced around in California, and then she was on her own by the time she was 16. But she didn't sort of let any of that those adverse conditions sort of lead her to a life that she didn't want to live. So she kept trying to find out where she belonged and was quite adventuresome and would bounce around from California to Colorado. She did a stint up in Alaska, and she ultimately ended up joining the Foreign Service as a secretary because I think she wanted to see what the world was about. And so she spent most of the 1950s in posts around the world in Manila, in the Far East, a little bit in Hong Kong, and then in London, and ultimately in the Dominican Republic, where she met a naval attaché named Edwin Simmons. She thought he was sort of a pompous jackass at the time. But when they returned to Washington, they got reacquainted and they were married about a year later in 1962.
That's a great story. So she and your dad were both they were both Depression kids, lived through that experience, and having parents of the same age and having spent time not only with them, but also their friends of the same vintage. I think there is a common trait that they just sort of, they were accustomed to not having much. No one around them had much. And so they didn't really complain later on in life because everything they had was better than what they'd grown up with, which was, you know, it was a tough thing to deal with, but it probably was a blessing for their outlook for the rest of their lives. And I think it is a trait of that generation.
I think that's very true. I think in some ways it's harder on our own kids who feel like they don't know how to define themselves relative to their parents who have achieved so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. And then she ended up owning an antique shop here in town, didn't she?
She did indeed. I was in kindergarten. Again, she was a little itching to get out of the house and have her own adventure that she could still have. And so she started a business with two other friends. They each pitched in $200. And then she had an antique store for 30 years in Alexandria.
So let's head up to your college time. I'm sure you had a number of different schools you could have chosen from. You opted to go to Washington and Lee down in Central Virginia. And in fact, you went down there as only the second class of women that the school had admitted after it had started admitting women the year before. So the obvious question is, you know, why did you decide to go to W&L? I mean, obviously, I'm sure there are good odds for dating purposes, but beyond that, what other things about W&L drew you there as opposed to other schools?
You know, as in most things, I think in my life, it's a bit of serendipity as well as a little bit of conscious decision-making. As you know, Ken, my sister was at Sweetbriar College with your wife, then girlfriend. I think you started dating her when she was at Sweetbriar. I don't know. I had visited my sister at Sweetbriar College, which was an all-women's college about an hour away from Washington and Lee. And as a high school student, I would visit my sister at Sweetbriar and we would go over the mountain to Washington and Lee. And it was super fun, right? You know, it was exciting and fun, particularly for a high school student. And so when I was thinking about where I wanted to go to college, you know, I naturally thought of the University of Virginia, but I had, you know, literally 30 kids from my high school went off to University of Virginia. So I didn't want to do what everybody else was doing. And that this Washington and Lee option seemed, oh, exciting. It was new because it was the first, you know, only the second class of women. I don't know if I would have been brave enough to be the first class of women at W&L, but it seemed like a nice option, a small liberal arts school. And then, you know, I also believe that the interview or the visit to the school has a lot to do with it, even though it's perhaps not the most rational decision-making to base it on, boy, it was a beautiful day and a nice guy showed me around and he drove me around in his Saab convertible. And then, you know, it was a done decision at that point. And it turned out to be a great one. The school was, you know, very small and it allowed me to be a big fish in a little pond, particularly as a woman there. The ratio was 7 men to 1 woman. And therefore, you know, it was a bit of an opportunity to be a pioneer. And, you know, if you spoke up in class as a woman, you were immediately labeled as sort of like a crazy feminist. I mean, literally, people would say, well, gosh, you know, I won't date Courtney Simmons because, you know, she speaks up in class, which is insane, particularly in retrospect. But it was the way it was. But I, you know, I flourished there. And, you know, the professors were attentive and interested in me. And I, you know, was able to excel there. And I ended up really enjoying it. I took a year abroad, came back and finished there, 1990.
Did you find that attitudes change vis-a-vis women during the time that you were there? I mean, I think W&L it's known for being sort of generally conservative. Gender-wise, it was obviously because it was a all-male school. Did you see that maybe people adjusted to the idea of women speaking their mind in class?
Yes and no. I mean, there was always the small group who sort of would get in your face at a party or in things and say, you don't belong here. And it always infuriated me, you know, when they were either my classmates or men that were younger than me, because I was like, you chose to come here knowing there were women. So I don't understand your position. And there were some dinosaur professors who literally would have different office hours for men and women. They would start at the beginning of class and say, like, ladies, my office hours are 3 to 5 on Wednesdays. Gentlemen, come see me any time you want. But that was a minority. I think most of the professors were thrilled to have women in the class because they did raise the standard. And by the time I graduated, I remember being at one of the local bars, the Palms, and having a fairly drunk alumni come up to me. And I was like, uh-oh, you know, you sort of tense up. And he said, man, you've made my diploma worth so much more because the school so is true. So much better than it was before I got there. So I think there was a recognition over time that, you know, that admitting women raised the standards of the university and civilized it in a certain way. It's not quite as much debauchery in the life.
Right. A civilizing force have a salutary impact on a whole bunch of men in one place.
And it was incredibly conservative, and I probably didn't appreciate how conservative until I went off to Yale Law School.
Yeah, there's a contrast there.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. Yeah. You know, I was joking with somebody who called from Washington and Lee recently that, you know, I think the only time I saw any sort of outrage or protest at W&L was when they switched from Coke to Pepsi in the dining hall. Like there was
the really important causes in life.
Yes, exactly. There was no other cause between 1986 and 1990.
Yeah, apartheid, those kind of things, no big deal.
None of that.
Don't touch our Coca-Cola.
Exactly. And I did, obviously I knew that it was, you know, male dominated and there was these pockets of pretty serious chauvinism. But I don't think I appreciated fully the context until I went to Yale Law School, where, you know, immediately upon arrival, there was huge controversy because the women and men were not being called upon in exactly the same ratio, right? So they, in class, women were not being called on in the same numbers as men. And this was a huge outcry. And I thought, you know, you have no idea. You really have no idea what discrimination is like. So it was good. And it was an important lesson for me on, you know, the context within which you are sitting is so important. Because at W&L, I was a crazy liberal, right? Like, because I spoke up in class. And so I was, you know, everybody said, oh, she must be a liberal, right? Because I spoke up. Whereas at Yale, you know, people, because I came from the South, and probably dressed conservatively, I was immediately labeled, you know, as a conservative. And also because I probably espoused some principles in class or questioned some assumptions that others did not. So I did take from that, you know, the context within which you're sitting is so important to how you are defined on a political spectrum or ideological spectrum.
And then when you finish up at Yale, you went off to clerk, as I said earlier, you clerked first for Judge Michael Luttig in the Fourth Circuit. And I think you said you were his first woman clerk. I think you told me that previously. Is that right?
That's true. Yeah, I was.
And was that notable for that particular reason?
I think it was. So one of the reasons I think Judge Luttig, you know, was drawn to my application was he too went to Washington and Lee. So he had gone to an all-male institution and sort of been through sort of male-dominated career path. And so having a woman in his chambers probably was a bit of a change for him, which he adjusted to. And I learned a ton from him. He is a, demanding of himself and those around him and exacting in his work, which taught me a lot.
Okay, so you did that for a year, and then you went off to the big league to be a clerk at the Supreme Court for then Chief Justice Rehnquist. So I guess first, how does one become Supreme Court clerk? I mean, you know, it's not like I get out of law school and walk into the Supreme Court with my D minus average and land a law clerk position. What's the process for people who haven't gone through it?
Yeah. So the process is, you know, I'm a big believer that, you know, there are not just 40 people who are qualified to be Supreme Court law clerks. There's hundreds. And there's a bit of serendipity, again, in being chosen by one of the justices. You applied at the time, and I know the times change. Maybe it's a different period of time now. When you're in your third year of law school, so even before you've done your first clerkship, you toss in applications. I applied to all the justices. And then, you know, you're lucky. You have recommendations, obviously, people speaking on your behalf. But for the chief, you never know what's going to spark his interest. One of the things about the chief is he asked you to go back to high school in looking back on your resume. So he wanted all of his applicants to go all the way back to high school because he wanted to see sort of the whole person. And then there would be something in your application that would catch his interest. So one of his clerks, you know, just had a deep interest in the Boxer Rebellion. And that was interesting to the chief. And so the chief hired that person because the chief picked people who he wanted to spend a year with and not people that necessarily were the first in their classes. And the other thing I admired about the chief, and there are many things, is he also didn't pick only from the sort of Yales, Harvards, Stanfords of the world. He looked broadly and was quite well known for, you know, hiring people out of the University of New Mexico or University of Arizona or other law schools, because he rightfully believed that if you were exemplary at one of those institutions, you would be a wonderful law clerk. And he looked for more than just, you know, the caliber of your scholarship or your legal skills. And when he chose folks.
So tell us about him. I mean, he was the Chief Justice, I guess, from between Berger and Chief Justice Roberts, right?
Yes.
So had a long stretch there. And obviously, you know, there's everybody loves to observe the Supreme Court and the justices and try to know where they're coming from and what they're thinking and how they're going to rule. You had the wonderful opportunity to actually be by his side for a year. Tell us, so what kind of person was he? He had a certain persona about him, but you knew there was a lot more there than just the persona.
Yeah, you know, I could talk endlessly about the chief. So he was very much a role model for me, right? So he took his work really seriously, but he didn't take himself that seriously. And one of his former clerks described him as entirely unpretentious, unflaggingly decent, and at times mischievously funny, which is really, I think, a great and apt description for him. So, you know, he had this enormous intellect and sort of encyclopedic recall for all the court's decisions. But at the same time, he had so many interests outside of the law and outside of his work. Like, he was an enthusiastic singer and fascinated by geography and could talk endlessly about the weather. He obviously adored his family. He followed every sport, basketball, college football. He swam, he painted, he wrote books, even though he was sort of self-deprecating about the quality of his writing. He wrote several books on areas of things that interested him. He bet on everything, like everything, the weather, who was going to win every sport, famously bet on elections, but then decided during Bush versus Gore that he had to...
Probably not a good idea.
not go through with that bet. So, you know, he socialized, he played cards. He just was such an incredibly well-rounded person that it was a wonderful role model to spend time with him.
And a Gilbert and Sullivan fan, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I just got to ask you about that. You weren't there when he put the gold braids on? Or
No, I didn't. But, you know, he just wore them proudly and didn't...
I love that.
He didn't care when other people, if other people didn't think that was a great idea or not. He thought it was a funny idea. And so he was going to go through with it. And so, yes, he wore gold braids.
Just to bring this up to the current day, what we're talking about is his decision to put gold braiding or whatever it is on the sleeves of his robes.
He just thought that looked great. Like, he didn't have any other reason for it other than he thought it would look nice. So he had the Supreme Court seamstress sew on some gold ribbing around his sleeves. So, you know, he was a wonderful role model in so many ways, including the fact that, and I think related to the fact that he was sort of this well-rounded person, he never let his sort of ideology or differences in judicial philosophy interfere with his relationships with members of the court. So he was a great role model in that regard, too. And, you know, he's famously friends with Brennan, who Justice Brennan described him as the chief, as, you know, his best friend on the court. Because, of course, before he became chief, he was there for many, many years. I think he was there a long while beforehand. And, you know, he's also very close with William Douglas and all members of the court. So, you know, I think that was another really important role model in my life.
Sort of like the Justice Scalia, Justice Ginsburg friendship that people often remark on. Two people with, you know, from very different places on the political ideological spectrum, legal philosophy spectrum, but very dear friends. So fast forward up to actually Chief Justice Rehnquist's memorial service in 2006, you spoke. You were one of the speakers. That must have been quite an honor.
It was. I was very touched. You know, I spoke at a service at the court, and then I was also a pallbearer, which was very moving.
That's really something. Okay, so let's move up to your time in the White House. So you joined the White House right at the front end of the George W. Bush administration. That's early 2001, and this is pre-9/11, obviously. Let me just sort of ask you generally, how did you end up sort of in the George W. Bush orbit and in the White House? More serendipity?
Yeah, I would love to say that I plotted all this out, but I didn't. I was not a big campaign volunteer. I supported George Bush in that election, but not actively. But I just got a phone call. So I was sitting at my desk at Kellogg Huber, and it was December. after Bush versus Gore was decided, and somebody called me and said, hey, you know, somebody gave me your name. We're interviewing for the counsel's office. Would you be interested? And having not given it an enormous amount of thought, not having given an enormous amount of thought to going into the administration, I had kind of thought in the back of my mind, hey, if I were going to go in, that would be a really cool place to go, right? To have an insight into the White House. And so I was incredibly fortunate that somebody just recommended me to Al Gonzalez and his team when they were starting to staff up the counsel's office.
Incredible experience working in the White House. So just, you know, ask the question that probably everybody asks you, and I've gotten asked over the years, what was it like working for President Bush? What was your take on him as a man and as a leader?
He's one of those individuals who I've had, encountered who, when he steps in a room, he commands it, right? And he doesn't command it because he's sort of loud or there's not a negative interest energy around him. He's a very positive figure and sort of this warmth about him and a genuine concern for humanity, right? So whether it's, you know, I was at the end of my time working in the counsel's office, I was pregnant and obviously pregnant. You know, he was very interested immediately when he saw me about talking about, you know, my having a baby, right? And I'm, you know, he's a very busy man, and I wasn't unique in that role. Like he really genuinely cared about the people that worked there and also, you know, sort of humanity more broadly, you know, through his work in Africa, through his activities domestically. He had a genuine compassion and you know, compassion conservative, you know, got to be a bit of a sort of meme or to use today's parlance. But I think it really fit him very well. He was incredibly sharp. And as you say, would sort of go to the heart of the issue very quickly. You know, one of the regular meetings we had as associate counsel with him was about judges and picking judges. And he would always come prepared. He would have always read the materials and he would challenge us, right? He wasn't a rubber stamp. We would present, you know, whoever the candidate was, and he would challenge us. You know, he really was sincere about wanting to have a diverse pool of applicants and nominees. He would challenge us to go back and look again if he didn't think that we had sort of brought the best candidates to him. And he would do it kindly, but directly. And you had to be sort of always on your toes.
You always had to be on your toes with him.
And you always had to be early.
That's right. And early doesn't mean 1 minute before. It means 10 minutes before. Otherwise, you walk in and they're sitting there waiting for you and staring at you as you walk in the door, which is not the position you want to be in walking to the Oval Office. He was always punctual. You ran a great meeting. You got everything done and you got out the door so that you could go carry out whatever had been decided in the meeting. He set just the right tempo. So let me ask you about 9/11. You were in the White House on 9/11?
Eventually. So I, you know, everybody remembers their story. You know, and I'll preface this with a little anecdote. So my husband, John, had gone to work for Mike Chertoff in the front office of the criminal division at the Department of Justice. And so John, I remember about 2 or 3 months before 9/11, Chertoff had divvied up the portfolio for each of the people that was working in the front office. And I remember John calling me and saying, I have terrorism and Mexico. This is going to be, you know, awful, right? Like he thought there's nothing going to happen. Snoozer. Like I, so fast forward to 9/11, the day of 9/11, I was sitting in my kitchen and watching the Today Show, waiting for a chimney repairman. And I saw, you know, the first plane hit and I called John, who was, you know, in the criminal division, said, oh, this is terrible, thinking it was just some terrible, tragic accident. And then saw the second plane hit and, you know, knew immediately, you know, that it wasn't an accident. And then said, well, I need to get to work. So I, you know, obviously didn't wait for the repairman. I drove into the city, saw the Pentagon, continued over the bridge, and was entering the White House complex. And one of the security guards, it was much easier to get close to the White House at the time, said, you know, lady, I don't know why you want to come in here right now because there's a plane on its way. I don't know, being a fool, I guess, at the time. I didn't stop. I just thought, well, no, I need to go and help in some way. So I went on in and I think didn't really understand the gravity of the matter until I was in the West Wing and I was going up the elevator with the guy who's the head of legislative affairs at the time. And I sort of said, oh, you know, the security guy said there was another plane coming. And I saw Nick's face just get completely white. And I thought, oh shit, you know, like, man, I think at that moment I realized what was happening. And we went upstairs to the counsel's office, actually met up with, you know, Brett Kavanaugh at the time. We were both up there. We were quickly shuttled down to the basement in the West Wing, where we waited for a while in the mess hall. And then, you know, it's serious when the Secret Service comes in, as they did, and said, you know, get out. Ladies, take your shoes off and run. So we did. We all ran out of the gate, waited in Lafayette Park for a little while until we sort of organized and then moved to a conference room, a corporate office building, made themselves their office space available to us.
But the danger was very real. That's when Flight 93 was still in the air, right? And but for the passengers taking it down in Pennsylvania, it might well have come in to DC, which is its obvious destination, and, you know, the Capitol or the White House were the most likely targets. Okay, so after 9/11, it's sort of all terrorism all the time. You know, very real belief that there's a second wave coming. We've got to deal. You know, we've got to prevent the second wave of attacks, and then we have to find out was involved or who was responsible for the first attack, and then and try to build up our counterterrorism capabilities. So as I recall, one of the things that you focused on in those initial weeks and months was getting the Patriot Act passed through Congress. Let's just tell us in brief what the Patriot Act was, sort of how it came about, what its purpose was, and how successful you think it was.
So, you know, the day after, the next day we were let back into the White House, and I was invited up to the counsel's office and told to, you know, work with other members of our team, including Brett, to go up to the Hill and start beginning to negotiate what would eventually become the Patriot Act, which was an attempt to just ensure that the intelligence community and the law enforcement community had the authorities they need to prosecute this, what would become known as the War on Terror. You know, it was a dusting off of some want-to-have provisions that both FBI had in their, you know, file cabinet, and the Justice Department had in its file cabinet, and the intelligence community and the CIA had, in an attempt to ensure, you know, that the wall was known as the wall between the intelligence community and the FBI was broken down, that there was additional authorities that allowed, you know, not unfettered surveillance authorities or, you know, draconian, you know, authorities to take people into custody or anything of that nature, but really modifying existing statutes in a way that provided additional latitude, some additional collection authorities, call detail records and the like. And it wasn't, at least on the Senate side, you know, there was no pushback. In other words, you know, we were working with Leahy and Leahy's staff, and everybody was working towards a common goal. Yeah, there was negotiation around particular language, but nobody was advocating against sort of the idea of the needed reforms, you know, broadly speaking.
It's interesting. When you sort of go back and look at the Patriot Act, in, you know, with the perspective of however many years it's been now, people often will talk about the Patriot Act, label it as an overreach, partly because I think it's a misunderstanding as to what the Patriot Act contains and what it doesn't contain. You know, some people think that, you know, the rendition program was in the Patriot Act. No, it wasn't. So it was this set of capabilities, many of which the law enforcement intelligence community, as you said, had wanted for many years, and they now were able to get the authority from Congress because of what had happened on 9/11. And then, as you say, bringing down the wall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that in the immediate, I would say 6 months to a year after the Patriot Act, it suffered from some sort of bad communications, right? So I remember sitting with
the name itself.
Yes. Sitting with my husband, you know, watching one of these, you know, law dramas on the thing, and somebody saying, I can throw you in jail for 6 months and, you know, forever, because haven't you read the Patriot Act? You know, so it got some bad PR and it got picked up in the movies and in TV shows without much basis in sort of what it actually said or did, and I think it reinforced for me, and I've seen this again and again in my time in government, is the importance of a communication strategy can be as important as, you know, the underlying activity that a government agency is engaged in.
Very true. So the Patriot Act kept you busy after 9/11, getting it passed. And then, of course, after that, getting it implemented throughout the executive branch and then defending it. Fast forward, you take off some time to have your first child and then get called back to the White House, but this time to OVP. And why don't you tell us what OVP is?
The Office of the Vice President, you know, so Vice President Cheney and his counsel at the time, David Addington. So David had worked very closely with all of us in the counsel's office, counsel to the president's office, White House counsel's office, and was a sort of an integral part of the team. So when I was leaving in May of 2002, he said, hey, if you want to come back and work for me. He didn't have anybody working for him at the time that he would be happy to have me. So I was excited to do that. That was a great opportunity, a different portfolio. The vice president, you know, obviously, you know, has his role in the executive branch, but he obviously is also the president of the Senate. And 40% of the vice president's staff are at the time, 40% of the vice president's staff are Senate employees. So did all sorts of sort of, you know, ethics advising. It was during the reelect. So a lot of the sort of political action questions, the Hatch Act questions and the like, you know, I worked with the vice president's staff on, which was a completely different portfolio, but a fun one.
And Vice President Cheney, having been Secretary of Defense, was a strong voice in national security specifically, right? And played an active role in the interagency process as related to national security matters?
He did, although that was not my portfolio. So I didn't see him up close on those issues, but certainly he was a respected member of the team. But this sort of caricature that he was sort of the puppet master is not consistent with my experience at the White House, certainly.
So what you're referring to when you say puppet master is this sort of image that was put out there by some critics that Vice President Cheney was sort of calling the shots in the White House as opposed to the president calling the shots. And I can tell you from my time at the White House, I certainly didn't see that at all. That was at the end of the administration, but sounds like you didn't see that toward the beginning of the administration either.
I didn't. And, that image, you know, makes me reflect on. So as I, at CIA, as you walk into the CIA museum, and it was on my way to an elevator bank that I used to take up to the seventh floor, there's an image of, you know, President Bush at Camp David immediately after 9/11, sitting with Condoleezza Rice and George Tenet. And it's a very powerful image, and it makes it very clear both that he was in command and the pain that he had on his face about the experience, and that Dr. Rice was a really important voice on national security matters. And it is I don't want to say it's sexist to ignore her, but I do think it's very wrong to ignore her role in national security at the time, vis-a-vis, you know, Vice President Cheney, because I don't think that Dr. Rice would take the back seat to the vice president.
Or to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Or to anybody.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move forward in time. So you go back to private practice after your time at OVP, and then 2017, you're in private practice, got a very good practice. Things are going well. Sounds like you get another call about coming back in.
I did. And again, you know, I'm going to sound like I'm just sort of bouncing through my life and not planning, but I do remember this occasion very well because I remember it came out of the blue. And it was Tuesday, January 24th, 2017. And the night before, on a Monday night, so January 23rd, I was at a 50th birthday party, sort of remember when we could all go to parties, we socialized. And of course, you know, having been 3 days after the inauguration, the conversation sort of moved to Trump and the new administration. And it was a party that had many of people I worked with at the Bush administration. So naturally, people were talking about, hey, are you going to go back in or not going back in? And I said in sort of my usual, you know, me Ken, like emphatic, you know, no wait, no doubt. You know, I had absolutely no interest in joining the new administration. And I made that very clear. I just had no interest in doing that. And that was still my position the next day when I got a phone call from an old friend who asked me if he could present my name to Mike Pompeo, who was going to be the director of CIA. And he wanted to put my name forward as being the general counsel. And my position at the time was the same as the night before. Like, hey, thanks, but no thanks. You know, I'm sitting this one out. I don't need to think about it. And then I gave my old friend some other names to consider. And then I did. I took my dog, who's sitting here by my side, out for a walk. And I was on that walk, and I remember exactly where it happened. I was on South Lee Street, not far from your old house. When I got, I mean, it was like a burst of cold air. And I thought of my father, and I thought that he had given, you know, 40 years and endured three wars for this country, and that there are men and women every day in the military and the national security, you know, risking their lives. And it was not, a lot was not being asked of me to give up a couple of years of my life to be their lawyer. So I went back to my desk where I'm sitting right now, and I typed an email to my friend, and I apologized for being so sort of apathetic about the opportunity he was presenting me, and that I was not being asked to risk my life, but frankly, merely my reputation. And that if he thought I was a good person for the general counsel of CIA or any other national security position, that I'd be honored to serve. And 4 days later, I was driving into the campus at Langley for the first time to interview with Mike Pompeo.
That's a wonderful story. Thank goodness for the blast of cold air. As somebody who's very close to the agency and cares a lot about it, I'm very glad that your dad spoke to you. So you meet with Mike Pompeo, you get the nod for that position, but it's a position that requires Senate confirmation. Interestingly, and as I understand it, in the CIA, the positions that require Senate confirmation are the director and the general counsel and the inspector general. Interesting that the general counsel position is one that requires confirmation. For instance, the position I held at the FBI general counsel did not. What accounts for that?
Yeah, you know, there were a few times in CIA's history, you know, really going back a long, long way, where famous, infamous missteps by CIA, there's been upon review, a view that the lawyers were not independent enough. So originally, sort of post-1947, they found the lawyers among the operators and the analysts. Hey, oh, you have a law degree, why don't you also be our lawyer? So that was original. And then there was a period of time after some crises or mistake where they said, okay, you need to have more lawyers coming from civil life, right? Not being from CIA. And then, you know, it was not until the 1996 or 97 that the general counsel position became Senate confirmed. And I think it was also an underscoring of the need for an outside voice and independence, because as you know, Ken, having spent a lot of time around CIA, it is a very insular place. And even the lawyers, you know, they start their career there and then they, you know, will spend decades there, that there was a need for outside voices to come into to the general counsel's office. And that was underscored by the need for Senate confirmation.
So the agency has sort of two, generally speaking, two different, you know, categories of personnel, folks who are on the analytical side, who are analyzing the intelligence, and then the operators who are collecting the intelligence. And it's your job as CIA general counsel to provide advice to both of them, to those two groups. And you touched on this a moment ago, talking about the origins of OGC. You know, we've talked in our, I've been on your general counsel advisory group and on that same board for your predecessors. And one of the perennial issues is sort of how best to situate the lawyers in CIA to provide good, effective advice to the operators. Is it better for them to be housed with the operators or to have them up in OGC and then servicing the operators from a distance? I just raise that as an example of some of the, you know, the challenges that you have. And it's not different from, let's say, an assistant U.S. attorney, a criminal prosecutor who's working with agents who are building a criminal case. Same idea. You're assisting those people in trying to, you know, run their investigation, at the same time trying to explain where the boundaries are and the limits are, but trying to facilitate their efforts to get to the truth. Tell us about that. That must have been an interesting thing to step into, given the unique culture of the agency.
There are more than 150 attorneys at CIA. About half of them are what we call sort of forward deployed or embedded, with a component and sit side by side with, you know, either the analysts or the operators or, you know, the science technologists. And, you know, there have been debates over time about whether or not that's a good idea or not a good idea. It's never going back, in my opinion, right? We're never pulling back those people, in part because, you know, the workforce wants their lawyers close, and that's a good thing, right? So, you know, they work side by side, they get to know them, they have a common objective, they understand the objective, they understand their business better if they're sitting side by side with them. You always have to worry about sort of capture, that your lawyers are being sort of co-opted and captured by, you know, their component. But one of the ways we mitigate that is that our attorneys rotate. I still say ours, CIA's attorneys rotate.
It'll take a while to get past that habit.
So every few years, 3 or 4 years, our attorneys move to a different component or back to main OGC or the centralized parts of OGC, sort of the common ethics, you know, contracts law, intelligence support, litigation, the hub inside the hub and spokes model. And having them move around, I think, protects against it to a degree. But it is something that the attorneys themselves have to have, you know, a very clear idea of what their role is and ensure that they have the ability to say, yeah, when they need to, no, we can't do it that way. Let's see if we can do it another way. But sometimes you can't get to yes. And by and large, the workforce wants to do the right thing. They want to stay on the right side of the law. You do have sometimes in the heat of the moment, you know, some can get tough on the lawyers. And you know, and I heard more than once, and my attorneys heard more than once, you know, people are going to die if you don't. And, you know, you have to be strong enough and you have to know that your leadership within OGC, the Office of General Counsel, and then more broadly in the agency, you have to know that they have your back so that you can say, yeah, you know, I'm not going to be pressured into something. So it's a difficult job, but it's a fantastic job.
Yeah. And it comes with challenges that other general counsel positions just don't have. And I use my frame of reference, FBI OGC. I mean, for instance, we had U.S. laws, we had internal policy, we had the Attorney General guidelines, and, you know, Executive Order 12333, and we just followed that, and it was easy. You guys operate a little differently. You've got those various rules, internal rules and laws and constitutional requirements that you have to satisfy. But then you also have a workforce that's operating overseas in contexts where, you know, they might be having to take activities that might not align with the foreign laws. And you're sort of having to deal with that. That's sort of a unique challenge that you have. Also, you have to deal, and the agency has to deal with the coordination or cooperation with foreign services. And a lot of your effectiveness is based on how well you work with foreign services who have similar objectives, who have, you know, similar enemies, right? Our enemies in common. But that raises challenges because some of those foreign services don't operate in accordance with the same rules or respect for human rights that we would. And there are some judgments, sometimes, you know, value judgments that aren't really based on any strict laws that have to be made. And I assume that you as general counsel were involved in those kind of deliberations.
I can speak on, you know, you have a lot of issues you touch on in that, you know, speaking about the relationship to our foreign intelligence services that we work closely with or that the agency works closely with, you know, that was one of the sort of, I won't say surprises, but one of the things I hadn't had any experience with. So it's hard to overstate the important role that foreign partners play to the work that CIA is able to do abroad. But it does present, as you allude to, a number of sort of legal challenges. As I'm sure you can appreciate, we often deal with issues arising out of the human rights practices of some other governments around the world. And although it can be incredibly depressing to learn the details of other governments' practices, it's also sort of was quite reassuring to see how seriously the agency took it. And it was treated across the entire U.S. government and how much thought was placed and time was placed to sort of dealing with that issue. So there are a couple of ways that we did that. One is that our attorneys or the CIA's attorneys help administer internal CIA processes for identifying human rights abuses by foreign partners and designing mitigation plans to ensure that CIA provided information or CIA provided assistance was only used for lawful purposes. And then in addition to that, you know, a substantial amount of my time and the attorney's time was spent ensuring that CIA officers are not in any way at the risk of either civil or criminal liability under U.S. law based on their engagement with these foreign governments. The legal framework, as you were also alluding to, the legal framework for evaluating those issues is incredibly fact-specific and complex. And there was sort of a great deal of information that we had to gather and work through for each new fact pattern, which recurred with a frequency that was, again, at times depressing.
Right. And of course, that is an ongoing issue, right? I mean, it's not unique to this era. I mean, you look at the Cold War and some of our allies in the Cold War that we, you know, were linked arms with, were people in governments and countries that had abysmal human rights records. And the question is, you know, where do you draw the line between sort of aligning your interests and actually coordinating operations? It's a tough thing to do. So one of the unique areas, or, you know, not unique to the CIA, but you probably face that challenge more than any other agency's general counsel. Another issue that is relatively unique to you is the covert action program. So why don't you just give us a little overview of what covert action is, definitionally, and then what the process is and sort of how that process grew out of earlier situations.
Right. So like so much of CIA, history dictates where sort of the legal authorities and legal constraints have gone, right? So you can sort of, it's always, and one of the things that I enjoyed doing during my tenure as general counsel was helping to ensure that the lawyers had a full appreciation of the history of CIA. And we did some fun time sort of doing some history reviews. But let's step back. It might be helpful for the audience to understand, you know, broadly speaking, CIA has, you know, sort of four functions under statute. So one is collecting intelligence. You know, another is evaluating intelligence, the analysis function that you alluded to. A third one that people sort of don't often think about or talk about is that CIA or the director of CIA has responsibility for coordinating human intelligence across the intelligence community. So that role does not belong to the director of national intelligence. It remained with the director of CIA. And then there's the what we refer to as the fourth function under the 1947 National Security Act. And that fourth function is where you find the root of the authority for covert action, and it authorizes CIA or the director of CIA to perform such other functions and duties related to intelligence affecting national security as the president or the director of national intelligence may direct. So that's an incredibly broad authority. So that CIA's positive authorities are incredibly broad. And then that one is the broadest. But as you alluded to, CIA also has not only the positive authorities, but these constraints that grew out of missteps along the way. And the one you alluded to was the covert action statute, which is Section 503 of the 1947 Act. And it sets up a process that requires two things. One, it requires the president to have a written finding that meets certain criteria to authorize covert action. But in order to understand what covert action is, you know, you kind of have to understand not only how it's defined in the Act. So covert action means an activity or activities of the United States government to influence political, economic, or military conditions abroad, where it is intended that the role of the United States government will not be apparent or acknowledged publicly. And then it has a series of, but that does not include, you know, traditional military activities, traditional counterintelligence activities and the like. So it's those things where the U.S. government, the president has decided he wants to or she wants to affect political, economic, or military conditions abroad. But the intention at the time is to hide the hand of the U.S. government.
So to use as an example, sort of a notorious example would be the Bay of Pigs invasion of 1961. That was a CIA operation. It was the front people were Cuban nationals, but it was run, funded, and organized by the CIA. And then when everything went wrong, the administration had to acknowledge that it was a CIA operation. But that would have been an earlier form of covert action.
Right. And for some time prior to the amendments of 1991, which really codified the specifics surrounding the notice requirements and the writing requirements of the covered action statute, there was a statutory requirement to keep Congress fully informed of covert action. But during Iran-Contra and the Reagan years, Congress was not kept informed of the activities the CIA was conducting. And as a result of that, there were amendments to the statute again in 1991, which requires with greater specificity the written requirement by the president and then a notification to the Congressional Intelligence Committees. And then if there are any changes to a prior finding that is significant, then there needs to be another sort of notification process. And then there's, you know, additional procedures on top of that that are by presidential directive. And one thing that I'm not sure has gotten much attention is there was a very important National Security Directive 79, which President George H.W. Bush signed 1992-93 time period, which then goes into much greater detail about how covert action findings are going to be promulgated and ultimately presented to him for signature. The process by which those were done, that document, which was top secret, was declassified in 2018. And I'm not quite sure what led to the declassification other than the 25-year period. But it's a fascinating document. And one of the things that I always found really interesting is that there's a provision in it that says, and I don't have the language in front of me, but, you know, it says something to the effect of, to the extent possible, you know, you shouldn't undertake covert action that if it were disclosed, the American public would find not to be sensible. Right. So it has this sort of kind of notion that CIA, you know, whatever these findings, the covert action should be, it should be activity that the American public would be comfortable with, which I'm not quite sure how you implement that directive.
Yeah, how do you define and implement that?
What part of the American public do you look to? But actually, the notion itself is valuable.
Right, and the whole finding requirement, as you and I discussed yesterday when we were preparing for this podcast today, you were explaining how the requirement that there be a presidential finding before authorization of a covert action sort of traces back to the perceived need for the president to own the covert action. Harking back to you mentioned earlier, the Iran-Contra episode, where there was some concern that maybe the president wasn't fully aware of what was going on, or at least purported not to be fully aware of what was going on when a covert action was being undertaken. And so one of the fixes for that was to make sure that anything that qualified as covert action would be only done pursuant to a finding authorized by the president himself or herself.
Right. And except in the most extreme circumstances, it has to be written and signed prior to any activity being initiated.
One other area that's sort of near and dear to my heart is the relationship between the CIA and the FBI. And, you know, we've talked about culture and the culture of the CIA. One thing that has been much written about over the years is, you know, the fact that the CIA has a certain culture and the FBI had a different culture, and that caused somewhat of a, you know, a rift between the two agencies. You know, just some saying that the typical CIA officer was, you know, a Princeton grad who would then go into the spy service, and the FBI was more often a law enforcement person. The joke was a Fordham grad would go into do law enforcement in the FBI. Sort of over, you know, gross generalizations and oversimplifications about the sort of the culture and approach that each of the personnel of each agency. But for whatever reason, there, you know, as I started working with the Bureau and with the agency, you saw a very different world outlook. I did see after 9/11, though, and maybe this was just the imperative of the time, but, you know, with the wall down and the agency and FBI personnel working arm in arm, you know, having meetings every morning, starting with the, you know, at the Oval Office level and then down through the ranks, I've seen a real evolution there. And I've seen that sort of different worldview is not so clear cut when you get agency and FBI personnel in the same room. Just wanted to get your perspective on that, because you were in the Justice Department back in the early 00s and now in the agency as of the late 10s. Have you seen the same thing?
Yeah, well, first I'll say that if there are any CIA officers listening, they're going to like that sort of description of them as Princeton grads. I'm not sure that they would agree with it 100%, but they're going to like it. You know, I was very surprised, not surprised. I was pleased to see the extent to which CIA officers and FBI agents are working very closely together now. And, you know, we have CIA has a large number, a much larger than you'd expect number of FBI officers who are embedded and detailed at CIA now. And they really look at their work together as a partnership and very collaboratively. I think that the relationship between FBI and CIA has probably never been more healthy. I think there's a great deal of trust. There's a huge amount of information flow. And that from the sort of the line all the way to the top, Director Haspel and Director Ray had a great, great, great working relationship and relied on each other and spent a lot of time together. So, you know, I think it's really terrific. I think, you know, it's interesting to me, just having been at the Justice Department, that, you know, CIA, you know, sort of officers have a great mistrust for the Justice Department, while at the same time, they have a great deal of trust in the FBI. And I think that, you know, comes from, you know, having had colleagues sort of in the target of the Justice Department in the past with respect to prosecutions from RDI and rendition, detention, interrogation program and the like. But I'd like to see more trust along the way with the Justice Department.
Yeah, well, hopefully that'll come too. So let me ask you this, just a $64,000 question. You stepped out of the CIA headquarters on January 20th. What do you see as the main challenge or top challenges for the agency in the years ahead?
Well, you know, I'll take the start, because I do think that, you know, as a lawyer and ensuring that CIA operates within the bounds of the law, that you have to protect the health of the Office of the General Counsel, right? So as you know, Ken, I felt that when I stepped in, it was sort of understaffed, under-resourced, under-trained. And in 2 years, you know, with the great support from Director Haspel, she was an exceptional champion of attorneys. We have made tremendous strides to sort of build up the health of the lawyers, because I do think that's vitally imperative to the long-term health of the agency. Now, some folks at the agency or perhaps elsewhere won't see that direct relationship, but if you don't have a well-trained, well-resourced, well-staffed Office of General Counsel, there will be another, you know, mistake made by CIA, and that will result either in curtailment of its authorities or worse for the institution. And that's not in the greater interest of the sort of national security. So I'll start with that. But beyond that, I would say that the sort of big issues that I think the new team, which I, you know, have great admiration for and respect for, will face are twofold. One is sort of handling data, just like, you know, corporate America or other places in the government. It, you know, CIA is awash in data, right? And trying to make, sort of get its arms around that, ensuring that it is ingesting what should be ingested, you know, sharing what should be shared, making the best use of the data, and then not keeping it forever are important questions that the agency is going to have to sort of put its arms around in time. And then the other issue is a broader, you know, taking the steps that CIA and FBI have made together, working relationship, and broadening that out to other government agencies, sort of improving the relationships, integrating more, in particular with the Department of Defense, and to gain the sort of synergies of what CIA can bring to the table and what DOD can bring to the table, and ensuring there's, you know, transparency, integration, and trust on both sides, I think will, you know, yield the type of benefits that we've seen in connection with the CIA-FBI relationship and having that sort of happen elsewhere. Because, you know, to face the sort of problems that we have ahead and are encountering now, it's sort of the 21st century adversary, we're going to need a real robust whole of government approach to these national security questions. And that doesn't mean like everybody playing their lane. It means, you know, a fully integrated national security apparatus. So those are the two.
Okay. So look, we're coming up on quitting time here, but I guess the last question is, you know, we've gone through this fascinating life that you've had so far. You've packed a lot into your 25 years. Got a lot of years left. What's the next step for Courtney Elwood?
You know, I haven't really, you know, given in the 13 days of my semi-retirement, I haven't given that an enormous amount of thought at the moment. I'm busy attending to some much deferred maintenance around the household. But I do think that, you know, in whatever I want to do next, I have a lot of interests that go beyond national security, so it doesn't have to be in the national security space. I do think that I might want to pursue returning to an idea that I had in the sort of 2016 timeframe about some work in civic engagement. I think that the events of the sad, sad, tragic events of January 6th, a horrifying scene that we all saw, just brought to bear the importance of some meaningful civic engagement. And I'm hoping to do it in a very modest way, perhaps starting in the legal community and try to do some good in that area.
Try to get people talking to each other, not past each other.
Yeah, because my role models, like the chief, I think, growing up, I took all that for granted, right? And my own law school career, my work with the chief, my time at Kellogg Huber, who, is with people from very different political views. But I see that people coming behind me from Yale Law School or in clerkships do not have the same viewpoint. And if people at Yale Law School or in these fancy clerkships are not able to engage with each other civilly and actually listen to each other and learn from each other and find some sort of common ground, I think we're sort of doomed, right? And so I hope to make some sort of modest efforts in the legal community, either at law schools or through many friends who've become judges, to sort of try to build some bridges in those areas to see if we can do some good.
Amen. God knows we need it. So look, thank you for this. Thank you for talking about your role models. They obviously, starting with your parents, through the judges you clerk for and your colleagues and bosses in government, they've obviously all had a big impact on you, and they've done a lot of good through that impact. And I'm just looking forward to seeing years ahead as you are the same role model to other generations as they've been to you, and the good that can come of that. And your civic engagement, mission, and passion is has never been more important. So I wish you the best of luck with that. And just want to say thanks for the service. Thanks for answering the call each time you received that call. It's really important that you did. And thanks for being such a good friend and being with us here today.
Sure. My pleasure. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's all the time we have for today. Thanks again to my guest, Courtney Elwood. That's it for this week's episode of the United Security Podcast. Your hosts are Lisa Monaco and Ken Wainstein. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The senior audio producer is David Tatasciore. And the cafe team is David Kurlander, Nat Wiener, Matthew Billy, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Jake Kaplan, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Malley. And our music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Thank you for being part of the Cafe Insider community.